What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. Please give the show a like, i.e. a thumbs up. Please subscribe if you haven't already by hitting subscribe and then hitting the bell. And please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. We literally could not do this show without your Patreon support. When you join at the $1 a month level, you make this show possible. When you join at the $5 a month level, you make the show possible and you get bonus content, including extended interviews. And for this week, that means you get an extended interview with our guest, journalist Nick Bryant, who talks to me about Jeffrey Epstein and the death of one of his victims, Virginia Giuffre. Nick Brantley is a journalist and activist who founded Epstein Justice and who published Epstein's Black Book in 2015. And Nick is the second guest on tonight's show. And after Nick's interview, I will play a short clip from a Gabor Mate talk that I attended on Saturday. But my first guests on tonight's show are Oliver Stone and Jim DiEugenio. Oliver Stone is an award-winning director, producer, and screenwriter whose films include Snowden, Savages, Untold History, Platoon, Wall Street, JFK, and the documentary JFK Revisited. He is the author of Chasing the Light. Jim DiEugenio is a researcher and writer who focuses on the political assassinations of the 1960s, including the killing of JFK. He is the author of two books, Destiny Betrayed and the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. And he's co-author of The Assassinations, and he was the co-editor of Probe magazine.
There's also the issue of Joannides, which Jeff Morley of The Washington Post, the ex-Washington Post, has stayed on top of for years. Now, tell him briefly the Joannides story.
George Joannides was worked out of JM Wave, the big superstation in Miami, but he was also in charge of the propaganda arm of the Cuban exiles in New Orleans, the so-called student directorate there, all right? What makes this interesting is this is in the summer of 1963, when Oswald is interacting with these very same Cubans that Joannides is in charge of, all right? And so when House Select Committee begins its investigation in the late 1970s, the CIA wants to assign liaison officers, okay? And Blakey says, the guy's in charge, all right, but no one who had anything to do with the Kennedy case, okay, is going to be allowed to be a CIA liaison to this office. And they agree. And guess what? George Joannides is assigned to be a liaison officer, okay, to this committee. In other words, they lied to Blakey. And then when I interviewed the people in charge of the Mexico City investigation, Dan Hardway and Eddie Lopez, they both told me, Jim, we were doing fine until Joannides came in. When Joannides came in, It took us days to get the files requested. And then when we would get them, they were whited out. There were parts of them that were whited out. And there is Ioannidis standing in front of us with a big smile on his face. Okay. So this is what the CIA has done, even all the way up to the 1970s, to cover up their role with Oswald.
Yeah, I would tell the story, too. When Blakey found out that Ioannidis had been there in 1963, he really got livid, according to the testimony given by
Dan Hardway.
And he said, I will never trust the CIA again.
That's right.
And Blakey fell for, I mean, he played a huge role in this in covering up because he didn't know any better. The CIA has never cooperated, not once. Tonheim told us on the AARB that whenever the CIA came in, they would scratch their heads and say, well, give me a few minutes or a few days, and I'll find a reason to not give you this information. There was no cooperation at all for the CIA, ever. And this is, except now with Trump's putting this out, they tossed out hundreds of documents with unredacted, apparently, but not even, it's a bit of a mess. I mean,
I really have to give Tulsi a lot of credit, because I think she overrode the CIA and the FBI objections, you know, knowing that she had Trump at her back. Okay, and she might have overdone it, because there were some things in these documents that probably shouldn't have been in there. Okay, and there was a guy at the congressional hearing, if you saw it, I never heard of this guy before, this Davison guy. And I turned to Jeff Morley and I go, who is this guy? And he says, Jim, the Democrats wanted him here because he's going to make objections to Tulsi not classifying Social Security numbers. I go, what?
The guy who suggested this was like sloppy and endangering people. And
This is
President Kennedy's murder is a very important issue in our country. I think it overrides a lot of personal concerns. Another agent is Howard Hunt. We mustn't forget him.
Yes.
Want to summarize?
Oh, okay. All right. This is a very interesting story. You know, what Oliver was talking about was the Schweiker Hart Committee. Richard Schweiker and Gary Hart were working under the Church Committee. They were allowed to do a limited investigation of the Kennedy assassination. Angleton was called in. All right. After his interview, he was interviewed by the press about the JFK case. He made one of the most bizarre statements in the whole history of this case. This is what he said. A mansion has many rooms. I was not privy to who struck John. Could you get more puzzled? What happened was,
like who?
What happened was that Angleton had written a memo, a secret memo, and he had sent it to Richard Helms, and nobody believed such a memo existed. But this is what it said: we have to plan an alibi for Howard Hunt being in Dallas on the day of the Kennedy assassination. So everybody tried to deny this thing existed. And then Mark Lane found a guy who saw it, Joe Trento, this journalist from back east. It turns out that Angleton had showed it to him. And so they asked him, well, why do you think he was doing such a thing? And Trento says, knowing Jim Angleton, he was trying to send Helms a message saying, look, I'm not taking the rap for this. Okay. If I go down, you're going down with me. Okay.
I quoted Angleton to the committee. And when I said, Angleton knew all the grandmasters of the CIA. And he was a Catholic, a very interesting Catholic. And in search, I said, perhaps of repentance before his death. This is in late 70s. He said, this is Angleton's quote, if you were in a room with them, the founders, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. I guess I will see them soon. short of evidence, that's pretty much a very interesting statement, too. these guys are, Angleton was human. I feel like he was the most human of them. He was totally the opposite of Dulles. I think that Angleton did have some conscience, and I think it bothered him in the end. One other thing that came out, you asked about things that came out, and I think it is important. The film, when it came out in 1991, was, I was taken to task. I was run over the coals for my Vietnam statement. In my motivation for Kennedy's death, and this is, came to me from both Fletcher Prouty and Jim Garrison, was that Vietnam was essential to, they wanted to go to war, not only with Cuba, but with Vietnam. And that was, and also Laos, going back to 1960, but Kennedy had no interest in going to war in Asia because he'd been told by General de Gaulle and General MacArthur, stay out of that, stay out of a land war in Asia. And he heard them, and he stayed out of Laos. He, with his brother, they fucked it up. They what they call fudged it up. They formed a neutralist government, and they, you know, you have to be, you have to play a political reality, a PR game in Washington. You have to. So you have to always pacify the warmongers. He won his battle in Laos, so to speak, by not sending troops. And in the Vietnam situation, in 1961, 62, he sent advisors. In 63, he came to a conclusion that he would pull out of Vietnam. And we, it was finally, I mean, we had so much evidence that we put in, but in the AARB found the papers.
The SECDEF conference of May 1963, the AARB declassified that, all right? And at this meeting, Robert McNamara is saying, okay, let's hand in the withdrawal schedules. So every department, CIA, State, Pentagon, handed in their withdrawal schedules for getting out of Vietnam. So McNamara gets all the withdrawal schedules. He looks down at them. He looks up and he says, this is too slow. We're getting out faster. All right. And that is, that pretty much put the nail, the final nail in the coffin of these deniers.
Win or lose.
Oh, that's okay. John Newman listened to McNamara's debriefing when he left the Pentagon. And he clearly said there, Kennedy and I had decided that when the training mission was over, we were getting out. And it did not matter what the battlefield situation was. It did not matter if Saigon was winning or losing. We were leaving. Okay. So Oliver, you know, looking back, Oliver was absolutely excoriated for this whole Vietnam withdrawal thesis. George Lardner, in the first attacks on the film, called it a bunch of nonsense, you know? And now it turns out, well, and this came out in the 90s, 97, Katie, even the New York Times had to admit in 1997, they had a column that said Kennedy had planned to withdraw from Vietnam. And guess who that story was written by? Tim Weiner.
So why is this a controversial point? Why do some people reject this argument? I mean, you have this debate among leftists who say, no, he wasn't really anti-war. No, he wasn't really going to pull out. What's your what is that? What's your response to that?
It's very close to the what's his name? Seymour Hersh argument. Seymour Hersh. And by the way, his assistant, who I mentioned earlier, Halpern. Halpern was the one who was putting out all the anti-Kennedy propaganda in all the books.
Right. He was talking to Hersh. He was his main source for all this anti-Kennedy stuff.
They're saying Kennedy wanted to go to war as much as Lyndon Johnson. There was a continuation of an administration instead of Lyndon Johnson being a complete break from Kennedy. And we went into this in our film, especially in the 4-hour version, all the foreign policy decisions of Kennedy, all of them were changed over in Johnson's administration. All of them. The only thing that Johnson continued with was a Civil Rights Act, which I think Kennedy's death played a huge role in, because it was a it was the linchpin on which the Congress changed.
See, Katie, this whole thing about there being a continuation between Kennedy and Johnson on Vietnam was put out there by Johnson. All right. Knowing, and this is the worst part, he knew he was breaking with Kennedy. And so what he did is he worked on McNamara. All right. Because he knew McNamara was the point man for the withdrawal program. And he eventually beat him down. All right.
We had the phone call in the film, remember?
Oh, yeah. That's terrific. Where Johnson actually tells McNamara, now, why did you say this stuff about getting out? Okay. Why did you say this stuff about getting out in 1963? And he wants them to take it back. He actually wants them to take it back. And he says words of the effect, how can you say you're leaving a war that you know you're losing? That's the very worst part. Okay. And Rob Wilson, our producer, actually got the tape of that and we put it in the film.
You know, you've been smeared by the media as a conspiracy theorist. We saw some echoes of that at the congressional hearing that you both testified at. I just want to quote Texas Congresswoman, Democrat Jasmine Crockett said, previously classified JFK assassination files are public and show no evidence of a CIA conspiracy. And she accused Congress of, quote, giving a platform to conspiracy theories. And then she said,
there are holes. I don't want y'all to think that I don't think that there are holes. But when we're looking back, we need to look back so that we can look forward and hopefully do better.
I don't know what that means, but what is it that you, what do you say to those claims? And also, what is it that you do want to have happen? Because you said, Oliver, when addressing Congress, that you want this reopened. And you also said it's that you want people to forgive, but not forget.
That's correct. They're all dead. You're not going to get revenge. Right. But the whole case is rotten from the head. It, from 63 on, we've given you all these reasons, from chain of custody on the basic items of any homicide. And everything was ignored. The autopsy was the farce, a complete farce. And we don't even know the photographs are screwed up. We need to go back to the beginning and show the people, like the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in whatever, South Africa or in Cambodia, there was one. After wars, after these internal upsets that we had, it's good for a country to look at it honestly, but we have never been able to investigate anything honestly. Congress, every time they open an investigation, it dies off. It doesn't go anywhere. The Church Committee included, which was the most, I think, the most honest committee we ever had with Frank Church. But, you know, when now you mention an investigation committee, I wish Representative Luna the best of luck. But my God, she's barking up a huge tree here. She asked for the Martin Luther King papers, the Robert Kennedy papers. Why not ask for Malcolm X, too? You know, really, she's taking on a huge task. And the odds are obviously against her. But, you know, What can America do if we can't get to the truth?
You know, to say something about Congresswoman Luna, when me and Oliver got to Washington for that hearing, there was a meeting in her office the day before. And I thought when we got there, I thought there were only going to be five people there. Me, Oliver, Luna, the guy who was escorting us, Jake, and Jeff. We walked into that office. It was packed. You couldn't sit down. There was standing room only. That's how much these people on that committee were interested, you know, in what we were going to say the next day. And that meeting went on for 90 minutes, you know. So, you know, God bless her. I hope she really keeps it up. And I hope she ignores people like Jasmine Crockett, okay, who want to ignore John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy is more for civil rights in 3 years than the three previous presidents had done in three decades, you know?
And, you know, I wanted to bring up this question of, you know, partisanship, because obviously Donald Trump presents himself as an opponent of the deep state. He presents himself as anti-war, but you yourself, Oliver, tweeted out the other day, what the hell is going on? Trump has turned into Biden, mercilessly, relentlessly bombing Yemen and aggressively seeking a new war with Iran. So on a kind of related note, I mean, how much of a transparency champion is Trump? How much is he fighting the deep state, or does he just use this as a rhetoric?
I don't know the answer to that. I really would like to know the answer, and I think it will become evident in the next year. You know, you have to hope, because there's no other hope. There's no other way. We're stuck in a Biden loop. You know, it's just going to go on and on and on, and we're going to spend more and more money and more wars. And I'm worried that Trump raised the Pentagon budget. I don't understand. If I wish it had been, I wish he put Musk in the Pentagon. That would have been vacuum thing over there. We need that. But so, in other words, yeah, America's at another question mark. We don't know. I think our country has to deal with some realities. If it doesn't, the world is going to teach us how to deal with realities. And I think, you know, we can't be the center of attention. We're not the movie star we were, and tell the whole world what to do. Those days are over. There are other players now. And I think we're going to have either go along with it and understand it and cooperate with it and make a better world, or we're just going to be fighting hopelessly against the tide of history.
See, Kennedy said, you know, America cannot afford to be on the wrong side of history. Okay, in these colonial struggles, he was referring to that. Well, we've now seen what happened, because now you have the rise of BRICS. Okay, I think, are going to be on the right side of history, you know, which is something Kennedy warned about. Yeah. You know?
And, you know, this is something you'll hear again and again. Why does this matter? It's ancient history. Okay, maybe there was a conspiracy, but who cares? There are more important things to be talking about. What is your response to all of those arguments?
If it happened as we think it happened, the concept of a democracy was destroyed on that day. Kennedy was definitely moving in a direction to make peace with the colonized countries. He was talking to Nasser. He was talking to Sukarno in Indonesia. They loved him. Castro even was willing to make a deal. And Khrushchev, don't forget, Khrushchev was becoming a partner with us. That was the beginning of detente. So everything turned the other way. When Johnson came in, it was a continuation of the Dulles regime of Eisenhower, and the opposition, our hostility to anything that was change. I think it was economic. I think the United States had a certain economic monopoly on the world that it wanted to continue, and was frightened of change. All the changes in South America, every one of them was opposed by Johnson. And that was the beginning of something that was important to the world. And in the other countries, India, Indonesia, very important. Actually, Indonesia is more important than Vietnam in terms of its wealth and its geographic center. Indonesia, we got rid of Sukarno. That was a dream of Dulles. So these things are very important.
Lumumba.
Right. The Lumumba case also.
Yeah, the Congo case. That was sad. We signed on to this repression, and never did that change that Kennedy wanted. That reverberates down to today. Looks what's going on in Iran. Do you think we could have done well with Iran? We could have solved this thing. We don't have to be their opposition of Iran. We made enemies. We created a theocratic state, actually, with our opposition. Our coup d'etat in Ukraine is a disaster. And that was us. Don't kid yourself. You can use Ukraine and blood. They're just proxies for us. As it has been in every single coup d'etat.
And you even have Boris Johnson calling it a proxy war. He's the guy who went down there to tell Zelensky not to negotiate with Putin. You know, you're called a Putin puppet if you say it's a proxy war, except you have Boris Johnson saying that. So I guess he's a Putin puppet now.
Well,
and you know what else I think is interesting is, so obviously looking at what happened to JFK tells us a lot about our history and our present, but also looking at the reluctance or the refusal to look at what happened tells us a lot about our past and our present, right?
Yes,
it does. Dangerous for well,
it's people like you who keep bringing it forward, bring out the history time and again, and it will be heard. We have to believe in the power of a new generation, and they're listening, because obviously we didn't succeed in what we were trying to do.
But you made a big dent. So it must have been like infuriating, and it must have been I mean, was it disappointing because you achieved so much with the JFK film and then no one does anything about the revelations? Was it like a
That's the nature. It's very hard when the center or the establishment makes a judgment like the Warren Commission and it's over, you know. Opening up something again is the hardest thing in the world, and bringing, letting in the light. But it did happen in South Africa, in Cambodia. It's happened before.
South America.
And it could happen in this country if we have a change of spirit and we understand and we go back. But, you know, we try. We try. And generationally, it gets passed on. Robert Kennedy's message is as strong today as John's message. Martin Luther King. Malcolm X said all these things way back when, you know. By the way, there's a new book by, I want to just mention, by James Douglas, who wrote Kennedy and the Unspeakable.
JFK and the Unspeakable.
JFK and the Unspeakable. Beautiful book. It was one of the best. The best book about the assassination. And he's gone into, in this new book, he ties together Robert, Malcolm, and
King,
and Martin Luther King, and John. So he's got four of them going, and it's a fabulous factual book with a lot of detail. I'm just looking at it. Just want to read. So there's hope in the people like this we have in this country.
See, one thing I want to add, he was mentioning Indonesia, which is the bloodiest CIA coup ever. All right, to bring Suharto to power, and he stayed in power for three decades. We had a guy named Brad Simpson, was one of our witnesses, one of the interviews that we did for JFK Revisited. And he said, and he's probably the foremost expert on the subject. See, Sukarno's overthrow would not have happened if Kennedy had lived. Mm. Right? So yeah, I don't think it gets very much better than that. You got the foremost scholar on the subject telling us that, you know. So that's why the JFK case is still important, because things change so radically, you know, within just, you know, a few months and then a couple of years later after his assassination. And everything today is militarized, you know. That's like the first arrow in the quiver. You know, is we have to bomb Yemen. We have to go with the war with Iran. We have to send billions of dollars into Ukraine, you know, et cetera. There's no such thing as diplomacy anymore. You know, and one of Kennedy's great lines was never negotiate out of fear, but never fear to negotiate. You know, well, that's been lost.
Well, thank you both so much. Is there anything you want to let us know that you're working on?
That I'm working on a book about the whole thing, my film career, and a new movie. Maybe we're trying in this marketplace. So I don't like to talk about it specifically.
Is it a documentary or not a documentary?
It's a movie. It's a movie. Oh, okay. Movie and a book. A book is very hard to write too. I did with the, you read my first one.
Yeah, it's great. Chasing the Light. It's great.
Love your dog. Where is he? Say hello.
Thank you.
What's his name?
Bucky, B-U-C-K-Y, named after Bucky Pizzarelli, who was a jazz guitarist who my grandparents loved.
He looks very smart.
Yeah, he is, yeah. And Jim.
Okay, well, right now, I'm actually not working on very much. I just have my website, kennedysandking.com, and I have a Substack column, all right? I'm always working on those.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for everything that you do. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
That was a great chat. And we will be releasing an interview with Jim about the killing of Martin Luther King as a Patreon next week. But this week, our Patreon is an extended interview with our next guest. And that guest is Nick Bryant, a journalist and activist and writer. Nick published Jeffrey Epstein's Black Book on the internet in 2015. And he's the founder of Epstein Justice, which you can find out more about at epsteinjustice.com. Nick is also the author of The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal, and The Truth About Watergate, A Tale of Extraordinary Lies and Liars. So here's part one of my interview with Nick Bryant. Nick, thank you so much for joining.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Katie.
So you are an expert on not just Jeffrey Epstein, but I would say on all sorts of corruption, all sorts of things that get dismissed as conspiracy theories. But of course, conspiracy theories are often just realities about conspiracies that actually exist. Before we talk about how you became involved in the Epstein investigation, obviously there's some very recent sad news about Virginia Giuffre, one of the women who has made accusations about Prince Andrew. She originally made an accusation about Alan Dershowitz, about Epstein.
About a whole bunch of people, Ehud Barak, Les Wexner, Jean-Luc Brunel.
What should people know about Virginia, about her story, and about her death?
Virginia had a very, very difficult life. She was molested at a very young age, and then her parents she was from a dysfunctional family. And her parents threw her into foster care, where she'd run away and run away, and they'd take her back, she'd run away. And then she ended up being on the streets, starting at about 12. And when you're a young girl to survive on the streets, there's a lot of unsavory things that are inescapable. And then she was eventually found by a pedophile named Ron Eppinger, who kept her sequestered in a apartment in Miami all day. And then pedophiles would come in during the day and pedophiles would come in at night. And then Eppinger eventually got busted. And she reunited with her father, who was working at Trump's Mar-a-Lago as a maintenance man. And he got her a job in the spa. And her dream was to become a masseuse, a massage therapist. So she had a book on it that she was reading. And there was Ghislaine Maxwell. And Ghislaine Maxwell said, "I know a wealthy philanthropist, and he will put you through massage school if he likes you." So that's how she eventually got sucked into it. And she went to Epstein's home, his Palm Beach mansion, home, whatever. And there Epstein was on his little table. And she had already done this innumerable times. So it came, what Maxwell and Epstein wanted her to do came to her, unfortunately, very naturally, because she'd been molested so many times by the time she met Epstein. And Epstein didn't, the thing about pedophiles, especially ones that are pandering them to very wealthy and powerful people, you cannot really pull a kid off the street and expect them to perform for a wealthy, powerful guy. They have to be socialized. They have to be, for lack of a better word, trained. And Virginia was already trained, and she was with Epstein from 2000 to 2002. And actually, she was in the inner circle. She was flown around all over and abused by very powerful people. And what ultimately led to her break from Epstein was Maxwell gave her a ticket to Thailand and said that she could take a massage course there. They had enrolled her for a massage course in Thailand. And the reason why they wanted her to go to Thailand is they wanted her to pick up a child and take her back to the United States. And what's amazing about Virginia is she had the conscience, the moral barometer, and she didn't want to indoctrinate anyone into that life. And while she was in Thailand, she met a guy from Australia, and she told him what she was up to and why she was in Thailand. And they kind of had an instantaneous love. And he was from Australia, and she went to Australia, and they got married shortly thereafter.
How did you get to know Virginia?
I wrote a book called The Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal. And that was about an interstate trafficking network in the 80s that got covered up. It was very similar to Epstein's network, almost like a carbon copy of Epstein's network. And I saw what was happening in the Maxwell trial. Maxwell was the only one indicted, And she was indicted on two or three conspiracies, and no one else was indicted. And I knew that it was a cover-up. I mean, I knew beforehand that it was a cover-up, but what the feds were getting away with Maxwell, I was really, really angry about, because Maxwell was only indicted on one count of child trafficking, which is a heavy sentence in the federal system. It's 15 to life. And she should have been indicted on 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 counts of child trafficking. She should have never seen the light of day. And as I said, she was also indicted on two or three conspiracies, and no one else was indicted. So I knew that it was going to be a cover-up. And I was kind of fomenting a protest. And I wanted to protest what was going on there. So, and I put together a protest across the street from the courthouse where Maxwell was being tried. And I was tweeting about it. And that's how I met Virginia. She saw that I was very much an activist in this area. And we just kind of hit it off to a certain degree.
And a lot of people, of course, have commented that in the past, she said that she wasn't suicidal, kind of planting a seed that if something happened to her, that people shouldn't believe it's suicide. Now, it seems like she has died by suicide. That doesn't mean, of course, someone can die by suicide, and that doesn't mean that there's not a somewhat causal relationship between the person who abused them and the person who does that. I mean, that's probably too strong. I should rephrase that, because I don't want to suggest that it's kind of an inescapable outcome of it. But obviously, there's a relationship between what was done to her and her mental health struggles. Do you think this was suicide?
She tweeted that in 2019. And in 2016, she gave she sued Ghislaine Maxwell for defamation of character. And that's where she named all the powerful men, was in a deposition. And I think she was frightened at that point in her life, because those documents were unsealed in 2019. And people could see exactly who she named. And I think that she was frightened, but she was a true warrior. And she was, when I met her, she was really, really gung-ho on helping other survivors of sexual abuse. And we had talked quite a bit, and I put together a petition because of the miscarriage of justice that the Maxwell trial was. And she signed it. And I got to know a couple other Epstein survivors too, and they signed it. I didn't know all the ones who signed it, but I got to meet a number of them. And with Virginia, I was speaking at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation has a summit, international summit every year. And I've spoken at three, but I was speaking at one of those. And I don't know if she asked me or if the National Center asked me, but she spoke at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation's International Summit that year. And she did a really good job. And then she had made a lot of money suing Ghislaine Maxwell, millions. And then I'm sure that she got millions from Prince Andrew, that litigation too. And she was really, really determined to open up a rehab in Florida for victims of sexual abuse. And also started an anti-trafficking NGO. And then at a certain point, she just disengaged from everybody. She disengaged from me. She disengaged from the Epstein victims that she'd befriended. And she just kind of drifted away into Australia. And that perplexed, I think, a lot of people. Why? Because she was so gung-ho at one time, and then she just kind of just drifted away.
Right. And do you have any, I mean, a lot of people were kind of confused by this post that she wrote on Instagram, where she talked about having been in an accident, and she posted a photo of herself, and you can see she's black and blue. She said she only had a few days to live because she had gone into kidney renal failure. Do you have any insights into what she was talking about? Because this was more than, I mean, this was March 30th. So it obviously was, she had more than 4 days to live, but.
Yeah, I can explain that. She got into an accident on March 24th and she was hit by a school bus. Her car was hit by a school, or the car that she was a passenger in was hit by a school bus. But it wasn't a big accident. And actually, the West Australia, that's the state she was in, West Australia police, said that there were no injuries. But she was driven from that accident to a hospital, and physicians there said that she had some kidney-related issues. And then she checked out the next day, and then about a week later, she went into a different hospital. And that picture that you saw of her was her either her first or second day in that hospital. And she was in that hospital, and that was a beating that her husband administered to her. It wasn't an accident. It was a beating. From that hospital, she told People magazine that she had taken on Epstein and Maxwell, and now she had to take on the abuse of her husband. And her husband beat her up in January and preemptively filed a restraining order on her for violence. And he was awarded the three kids, which really broke her heart. So you've got someone that's endured a lot of trauma over the years, a lot of sexual trauma, starting at a very young age. And I don't think that her husband was initially abusive, but I think he became increasingly abusive. And you saw that picture. I mean, that picture was not an accident. That picture was a beating that he gave to her.
Wow.
And then she was discharged from the hospital. And she actually had to see a magistrate because of her husband said that she'd text her and that had broke the restraining order.
That she texted him.
Yeah. And that had contravened the restraining order. So she had to see a magistrate a couple of days after she got out of the hospital. She was at that hospital 6 or 7 days. But her attorney pled not guilty or asked for a continuance. And but she was due in court the following month.
Wow. Really sad.
So I think what you have with Virginia is a lot of trauma and then heavy domestic abuse. And victims that have been through child sexual abuse are three times more likely to kill themselves than the general population. I think you had a perfect storm with Virginia. And given her abuse at a very young age, I'm pretty sure that she had dissociative identity disorder too. And that is another layer that can exacerbate someone's psychological health.
And it's so frustrating because, of course, people develop these coping skills or behaviors that are often pathologized. And then that is used to dismiss what they say. So they're abused and they develop certain things from that abuse, and then they're not considered credible, or they're considered damaged goods, and so you can't believe what they're saying. So it's this like cycle.
Well, people that have dissociative identity disorder can definitely tell the truth. I mean, that's been shown.
I was just paraphrasing.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying, but because I've been in writing about and researching about child trafficking for 22, 23 years, I've met a lot of therapists and psychiatrists who work with people that have been through child sexual abuse. And that's definitely a powerful coping mechanism for them, is because when they're getting abused, they switch to a different altar so they don't have to feel that pain. And that just becomes part of their lives is switching altars. When they're feeling pain, they'll switch altars. So, and generally, people with DID don't really get it diagnosed till they're in their 30s. It's not a diagnosis that comes easy because usually they're run through various psychiatric providers and psychologists that really don't know what they're doing. And they're given antidepressants and antipsychotics and different psychotropics. But generally, the wheels start to come off for people with DID in their 30s.
Mm.
Because that system of alters starts breaking down.
And how do you know what you described about her husband being abusive? And is that something that you, did you ever speak to her about that? Or how did you find out that information?
No, it's her brother and sister, or her brother and sister-in-law have talked about it. And as I said earlier, Virginia just disengaged from us. She was really gung-ho about starting this rehab for sexual abuse victims and starting an anti-trafficking NGO. And then all of a sudden, that was it. I mean, there was an Epstein victim that you come very, very close to. And she just chopped her out of her life and disengaged from, she disengaged from me. She disengaged from, I think, everybody that was affiliated with Epstein or trying to remedy Epstein. I want to set the record straight about that. But yes, her husband, the picture that you showed, that was a beating that her husband laid on her. It wasn't a crash. And I've spent, since I found out about it on Saturday, I've really dug into it. And I've really worked very, very hard to discern the truth, because there's so many different stories, and I owe Virginia the truth, and I've worked pretty assiduously to find the truth in that situation, and I believe that her husband was extremely physically abused.
And why was she, what do you know what she was referring to about having 4 days left to live?
Okay, so what her brother said was that she did with the first hospital she went to after the crash. The doctor said that she had some kidney related issues, and he said that if you don't get help for this, you're not going to live very long, or you're not going to live 4 days. So that was taken out of context, but she was on a lot of pain medication when she made that. And actually, she didn't think she was posting to Instagram. She thought she was posting to her private Facebook page. And these are things that I just kind of want to tell the truth about for Virginia and straighten out, because there's been so much misinformation regarding her case and her death.
Right. And can you shed light on what we do know about the participation of Ehud Barak and Prince Andrew? She obviously also accused initially Alan Dershowitz, and then she walked that back, which, I mean, I'd like to ask you about that. That to me does not mean that it wasn't true, given how litigious and harassing and threatening and bullying he is. So can you talk about what we do know about those three individuals?
Alfredo Rodriguez stole the black book. And I got a copy of the Black Book in 2012, and I put it on the internet. Well, actually, Gawker and I put it on the internet in 2015. And Alfredo Rodriguez circled a bunch of names. And what he was trying to do was he was trying to sell the Black Book to one of the lawyers that was litigating for some Epstein victims. And the lawyer called the FBI. The FBI did a sting and then got the Black Book. And the names that Rodriguez had circled had more gravitas as far as Epstein's perfidious lifestyle than those that didn't. Although there were a number of perpetrators that were in that book that he didn't circle, but he did circle. He circled Ehud Barak, he circled Les Wexner, and he circled Alan Dershowitz. And Virginia, under testimony, said that she'd been molested by all three.
Wow. Shifting gears a little bit,
Can you talk about the Epstein files, which you say don't actually exist? And wanted to have you respond to this video clip of Donald Trump talking about the Epstein files, but also about other cases. Let's take a look.
Mr. President, when can we expect the Epstein documents to be released, the rest of them?
Which documents?
The Epstein files.
I don't know. I'll speak to the Attorney General about that. I really don't know. I know that we've done the RFK, the Kennedy, Martin Luther King is out there very shortly. So we'll find out. But we've really, really announced we're doing them in full transparency. You know, when we did JFK.
So to what extent is any of that true? I mean, have they done JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King? And what have they done so far with Epstein?
I don't really focus on JFK or RFK or Martin Luther King, but I am focused on Epstein. There is no Epstein list. It's apocryphal. It's like Jeffrey Epstein ran a travel agency and he had a list of all the perps and he kept them on his refrigerator with a magnet. I mean, that's nonsensical. Epstein had a black book. And he's got a lot of flight logs, and there's a lot of names of perpetrators in the black book and on the flight logs. I don't know how it got started that there was an Epstein list. It's apocryphal. Maybe people just wanted to believe that there was an Epstein list, but what there is, and what's really incriminating, is the FBI drilled Epstein's safe, and there were hundreds, if not thousands, of disks. And then that was reported by the New York Times, and Business Insider reported that there was also hard drives. And the FBI agents also came across either hundreds or thousands of images of child rape material, too. So Epstein had quite a cache of child rape material. And this is what's really, I mean, there's so many egregious things in the Epstein case, but this is really egregious. Those girls that were used for Epstein's cache of child rape material, those girls are going to be very, very damaged for the rest of their lives. And it's going to be very hard for them to join society. And they're going to have to work very, very hard and just to live kind of a baseline life. And because the feds were covering up Epstein and all the perpetrators, and we know who a lot of the perpetrators are, we know who a lot of the pimps are, I'm willing to bet everything I've got that the FBI didn't try to identify those victims and help them, which is, I mean, there's so many miscarriages of justice in the Epstein case. That really sickens me that there were all those images of child rape material and the feds just ignored them, just ignored those girls. And those girls are going to be damaged for the rest of their lives.
Can you talk about what we know about Alan Dershowitz?
Well, Dershowitz, Virginia named him as a perpetrator. And Maria Farmer submitted an affidavit saying that Dershowitz went upstairs to where the young girls were. And then another Epstein victim named Sarah Ransom also submitted an affidavit that said that, and she said that she'd been had sex with Dershowitz. And if you look at Dershowitz's record, and he wrote a op-ed for the LA Times, where he thought the age of consent, I think, should be 14. And it didn't really matter how old the other individual was. I think Alan has a long and illustrious history of misogyny. And why Virginia kind of walked back that a little bit, she said she may have made a mistake about Alan Dershowitz. I think that he had somehow leveraged her. I mean, that's just because she was really solid. When she litigated with Ghislaine Maxwell for the defamation of character. I mean, Ghislaine Maxwell threw a bunch of reptilian lawyers at her. And they really tried very hard to break her. And she stood strong. So I'm inclined to believe that there was some kind of extracurricular activity that Alan Dershowitz got wind of and leveraged Virginia with. And what's interesting is Virginia submitted an affidavit that said that she'd been molested by Prince Andrew and Alan Dershowitz and Jean-Luc Brunel. Brunel was Epstein's partner in a modeling agency where they would get underage girls. A lot of them they would actually buy underage girls in Eastern Europe. And Brad Edwards and Paul Cassell were the attorneys for Virginia at that point. And Cassell was a former federal judge. And they believed Virginia and enough to, when she said that she was molested by Alan Dershowitz, they put it in that affidavit. And then Alan Dershowitz went on the offensive. And Alan Dershowitz said, I'm going to get their law license and da, 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 and, you know, they're going to be drummed out of the legal profession. And it was the bite of a paper tiger. Actually, no one got their law license revoked. It ended up to be a stalemate. So that's one of the reasons why I think that there was some leverage on Virginia, because the litigation between Edwards and Cassell versus Dershowitz ultimately ended up in a stalemate.
I mean, he is a very pushy, I mean, it's an understatement, litigious and I think scary person. I mean, we can see how this is a totally different sphere, but obviously, you know, Norman Finkelstein, the political scientist, Alan Dershowitz, he and Alan Dershowitz, you know, debated each other. And then Norman Finkelstein exposed some shoddy scholarship, to say the least, by Dershowitz. And then Dershowitz really was successful in getting Finkelstein blacklisted and blackballed for quite a bit. But I wanted to ask you another question, which was about something that you talk a lot about, understandably, because it's very important, which is the Epstein Victims Compensation Fund. Can you elaborate on that?
The Epstein Victims Compensation Fund is a scam. And basically, it's there to ensure that there's no depositions. David Boies was instrumental in crafting the parameters of the Epstein Victims Compensation Fund. And so was Georgiana Feldman. And David, we don't know the criteria of the victims compensation, actually the victims compensation program. We have no idea. The criteria that they're using is not made public. 225 women have applied for compensation. 150 have been rewarded compensation. And of those 158 have declined, because if you get money from the Epstein Victims Compensation Program, you've got to sign an NDA saying that you can't go after any of your perps. So that program is being used to shut down victims that the feds couldn't shut down. And it's pretty heinous. And plus, I've spoken at a number of conferences over the years, and I've gotten to know a lot of psychologists. The International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation has an international conference every year. I've spoken at one of those, and I've spoken at one of their webinars. And actually, I contributed a chapter to a book that was published that a number of members of that society had contributed chapters to. And I've gotten to know a lot of therapists, a lot of psychologists, a lot of psychiatrists that work with victims of abuse. And I know a psychologist, and she's an eminent psychologist. In this field, she's known, but actually she's been on some documentaries and people would probably recognize her. And she had a client that said that she was trafficked by Epstein when she was under 10 years old. And the girl, the young woman now, described Epstein's home and other things around Epstein's home that she couldn't have possibly have known. And then I know another therapist, same type of a thing. where she had a client that said that she was trafficked by Epstein when she was under 10. Neither one of those girls got any kind of compensation from the Epstein Victims Compensation Program. And that is because, according to those therapists, they didn't fit the cover story. The cover story is that the youngest girl that was molested by Epstein was 14, which, you know, is pretty heinous. But I think that Americans would be even more outraged if they knew that Epstein was trafficking girls under the age of 10. And actually, there was an Australian newspaper that reported that Epstein's victims were as young as 11 or 12. But the American media there's so much negligence and malfeasance involved in the Epstein case. The American media is really good at digging up salacious dirt about the perpetrators, but they don't really seem to care about the victims. And I'm not aware of one media outlet that has screamed for justice in the Epstein case. And I certain organization that's called Epstein Justice, and you can find us at EpsteinJustice.com. And there was a big document dump last January, and CNN contacted me. And because I was the guy that put the black book on the internet, they wanted to talk to me about the document dump. And I talked to the producer, and we were texting throughout the day. And then I said to him, you know, while we're talking about this document dump and these documents, I'd like to talk about Epstein Justice too, because I told him the organization. And then I got a text about 10 minutes later that said, Nick, we're going to go another direction. So,
did not have you on?
No. That's happened to me a few times with the mainstream media.
And so what does this organization do that you have?
What we're doing with Epstein Justice is we want a congressional commission. And with a congressional commission, you can have independent investigations. And we want a congressional commission to look into Epstein. And it's pretty simple what we want, at least morally. We want to know why the government covered up child trafficking. When you cover up a crime, you're aiding and abetting that crime. So we want to know why the government is aiding and abetting child trafficking in the Epstein case. And we want the perpetrators who molested all those little girls to be prosecuted. Now, you think that that would be a slam dunk in a moral society. But we're going to need a majority in the House and a majority in the Senate. And that's what we're working for right now, is achieving a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate for an independent commission. And when people hear about commissions, they think of like commissions that, like the Warren Commission, that I don't think gave us a lot of truth. But congressional commissions have given us truth in the past. They've been different than presidential commissions.
Like the Church Commission?
Well, the Church hearings were amazing. I mean, the Church hearings gave us COINTELPRO, which was the FBI domestic spying program. They gave us Operation Chaos, which was the CIA domestic spying program. They showed that the CIA had funneled money to homicidal, genocidal dictators. And there were a lot of things that came to the fore with the Church Commission. And that's the kind of commission that we need. But it would be really simple. I mean, if the government wanted indictments in the Epstein case, they could have them tomorrow. I mean, it's really that simple. The New York Times wrote a full page article on six of the Epstein pimps. One was Ghislaine Maxwell, one was Sarah Kellen, one was Leslie Groff, one was Adriana Ross, Nadia Marcinkova, and Haley Robson. And only one of them was indicted, and that's Ghislaine Maxwell. Kellen, Groff, Ross, and Marcinkova knew all about that network. And there's a New York Times article that shows that they do. I mean, you could take that New York Times article and give it to a grand jury. And of course, you could call them. They would take the fifth. You could indict them all on child trafficking. And as I said earlier, that's a heavy sentence. child trafficking. And in the federal system, it's 15 to life. So if you give those women 5 or 6 lifetimes in prison, or if that's what they're looking at, they're going to roll over on the perps. I mean, that's how simple it would be. It wouldn't be complicated to start getting indictments on those. They're called procurers in the article, I believe, but they're really pimps.
Right.
So the government and actually the media has been very disingenuous when they give us this story that, well, they don't know who this person is or that person. Then the Department of Justice knows exactly who the pimps and perpetrators are. And that's what's really galling, is that this could be taken care of pretty quickly. If there was a will in the Department of Justice, if the Department of Justice wasn't so corrupt.
And again, to watch the full interview with Nick Bryant, go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. If you're watching this live, the Patreon will be available right after this show airs. And again, to learn more about Nick's organization, Epstein Justice, you can go to epsteinjustice.com. And the final portion of this show is a clip of Gabor Maté speaking at the United Palace in New York City on May 3rd. As people probably know, Gabor Maté is an internationally renowned speaker with expertise on addiction, trauma, childhood development, and the relationship of stress and illness. For his groundbreaking medical work and writing, he has been awarded the Order of Canada, his country's highest civilian distinction, and the Civic Merit Award from his hometown, Vancouver. His books include In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, When the Body Says No, The Cost of Hidden Stress, Scattered Minds, The Origins and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder, and most recently, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. Gabor Maté was a baby during the Holocaust, and as he mentions in the following clip, his mother handed him to a Christian woman who was a total stranger on the streets of Budapest and asked the woman to bring Gabor to the home of relatives who lived in relative safety, which she did. Gabor and his immediate family survived the Holocaust, but several relatives, including his grandparents, were killed.
In case anybody thinks the history began on October the 7th, in 2004, there was a study of the psychiatric state of Gazan children. A large percentage wet their beds. They were aggressive towards their parents. They had nightmares, they had anxiety and depression. This is 2 years before Hamas took power in Gaza. I'm telling you, I've been there 3 years ago. A year and a half before October the 7th, I was in the West Bank working with women, Palestinian women, who've been tortured in Israeli jails. And there've been tens of thousands of Palestinians tortured in the jails of Israel, as documented by Israeli Physicians for Human Rights, as documented by B'Tselem and Israeli Human Rights Organization, as documented by international organizations. Nobody talks about that here in the West. We just don't talk about that. And when I was there, I was told that there's no post-traumatic stress disorder here because the trauma is never post. It's ongoing. But let me tell you, it was bad enough the first time I visited there 30 years ago. It was bad enough when I last visited there 2.5 years ago. I don't have to tell you how much worse it is now. This is what we're doing to people. And I cannot but cry out. My heart breaks every day over this. And I'm telling you, I know physician colleagues of mine in this country who have lost their jobs because they've repeated what Israeli Holocaust scholars have said. And at least I can tell you, at least 4 Israeli Holocaust scholars, internationally renowned scholars of genocide, who have called what's going on right now genocide. And don't let anybody tell you that if you speak the truth, you're either a self-hating Jew, if you're not a Jew, then you're an anti-Semite. It's just the worst land that there is. going back to healing, there's that sad story of this kid who was born into this terrible circumstance. His grandparents died in Auschwitz when he was 5 months of age. On which very day, his mother's breast milk dried up. And I could go on, tell you all the difficult details of my first year. And I've been living under the impact of those events in many ways, and some of you I told you about. And all of a sudden, resentment. I'm like, why did this have to happen to me? You know, and so on. But there's another way to look at it. Think of the infinite love that my 24-year-old mother must have had to give me to a complete stranger in the street. When her husband was away in forced labor, he didn't know if she didn't know if he was dead or alive. When I was her only attachment, when her parents had been killed, her sister had been taken to the camps, she didn't know if the sister was alive or not, and she gives him to a stranger. How much love is there in that? Think of the Christian woman who takes me in the street of Gorbachev, who was not even supposed to be there in that Jewish district, and conveys me to these relatives in Haiti who are living under relatively more secure circumstances. Think of the love of my relatives who barely trying to ensure their own survival, taking this really sick baby and look after him. It's so much love and so much caring. So we could look up at this story as a tragedy of some kind. We could also look upon it as a manifestation of beautiful love in the universe. And that's the world that we live in. And when we find that connection with ourselves, and we see our connection with others, we actually find that love. Because actually, as Bruce Perry, a great American psychologist said, a great American psychiatrist said, in the title of one of his books, we're actually born for love. And I'll finish with one more quote for you. If I can just find it. Yeah, this is the word stress was coined by a Hungarian-Canadian physician called Hans or Janos Selye. He's the one that did the work in the laboratory that showed the impact of emotional stress on the physiology of the body. So he coined the word stress about 100 years ago, the way that we use it today. And Selye was a magnificent researcher and physician, but he was also a humanist. And you know what he said? He said that there's no question that in modern society, most of our stresses are emotionally set. And he said, most of our tensions and frustrations stem from the compulsive need to act the role of someone that we're not. And that's the message. Find out who you are, and for God's sakes, be who you are. Thank you.
Thanks so much for watching The Katie Halper Show. Don't forget to like and subscribe by giving it a thumbs up and by hitting subscribe and then the bell. And please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And you will be able to watch that full interview with Nick Bryant about Jeffrey Epstein and Virginia Giuffre. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much to producer Brad Bloom. Thanks so much to researcher Nate Newbern, podcast producer and editor Andrew Calloway, and Phantom Asfanta, not only for the clips, but also for recommending Nick Bryant as a guest. Bye, everyone. See you next week. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.